Hi, everybody. Welcome to the August edition of Power Word Talk. I am your best parasocial friend, Tal Aviazer. I am joined by a newcomer to the show, David. David, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
David and I are going to discuss a couple of topics. First of all, I'm just going to generally cover the history of Dungeons & Dragons video games, 50-year history, as economically as possible as I can do that. And then the main event, we're going to talk the video game sensation that is currently taking steam by storm, Baldur's Gate 3, and how we feel about it and what we might learn from it. Like I said, it's almost a 50-year history, Dungeons & Dragons computer games. And the 50th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons is coming up next year in 2024. So Dungeons & Dragons video games have pretty much been around almost as long as the game itself. I remember being in the late 80s. I'm not sure how old you are, David. I suspect I'm slightly older than you are.
A little bit.
I was in middle school in the late 80s, and there was, I think most people had like one really plugged in. I guess I would call this guy a geek. He was a little bit like the Eddie character in Stranger Things. You know, he was a metalhead and he was a really good guitar player and he was funny. And, you know, we played D&D. He was like my first DM and he was really, really smart. And he was like the person that I knew in like 1987 who was on the internet. And one of the main things that was happening on the internet in those halcyon golden days was that people were running things called multi-user dungeons, which were these text-based things where you would go into a dungeon that somebody had created, like on their BBS or whatever, and you would navigate through it. But D&D had been happening on video games for more than a decade, even before those multi-user dungeons of the 80s. The very first Dungeons & Dragons video game was created in 1975. By Gary Wisenhunt and Ray Wood. And it was really simple by modern standards. It was created for the Plato computer system, but you could create your own character. You could explore a multi-floor maze in search of a legendary orb and grail. And it was one of the first games to allow players to move back and forth between levels. And it had spells and items and weapons that you could acquire and add to your character. And that is 1975. So like one of the first things that people did, it's not going to be a shock, but like the people that first adapted like the personal computer, the home computer, these are mostly college students and high school students. Like one of the first thing people did was get a computer in their house was like, I want to play Dungeons & Dragons on this. So the history of like people having access to a personal computer and D&D and D&D video games is like all intertwined from the mid 70s. This is even like before I was born. It was followed by a game called Dungeon in 1975 by Dan Daglow. This was he was a student at Claremont Graduate University. And this was, again, these are all unofficial Dungeons & Dragons adaptations. TSR was not like licensing these college kids to make these games. But this was the first one where you could control a party of adventurers who worked their way through the titular dungeon. It had melee and ranged combat. It had auto mapping. It had line of sight, it had NPCs, and even a little bit of genuine AI for 1975. And then the game that some listeners may have heard of from 1979 was a game called Akalabeth. Have you heard of this game, David?
That I have not. I think you're still before my time.
Have you heard of the Ultima series of games by any chance?
Yes.
Okay, so this was like the proto-Ultima. By Richard Garriott, who's the developer of those classic Ultima games. Before he made those games, he released Akalabeth, which he made when he was in high school. And it was heavily based on Dungeons & Dragons. In fact, it was the initial versions as he was developing it were titled D&D 1 through D&D 28B. And then when he paid $200 to self-publish it, and he realized he couldn't use the name Dungeons & Dragons, so he just changed it to Akalabeth. And if anyone's played the Ultima series, this is like the Ultima. It's quite primitive, but it's recognizably D&D. You have a party. There are character classes. You go up levels. There are hit points. He self-published it for $200. It would eventually earn about $150,000 when California Pacific started distributing it. So you know, D&D themselves are kind of late to the table on this, you know, as they sort of traditionally have been in terms of getting into the digital space. A lot of people were making money releasing Dungeons & Dragons video games before Dungeons & Dragons was. But they did license, the first officially licensed Dungeons & Dragons game was made by Mattel for Intellivision. And that people might be confused. You might know that now Dungeons & Dragons is owned by Hasbro, which is Mattel's main competitor. But back then, TSR was the independent company that owned Dungeons & Dragons, and they were working with Mattel, and they made games for Intellivision. And this was like they ran off cartridges, but this was sort of thing where like they sold the veneer of Dungeons & Dragons, but it wasn't actually a D&D game in any way. It didn't use the rules, it didn't use the setting. The only thing it had in common with D&D was it was like a fantasy game. It was originally released and was called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. This is 1982, and it was marketed in some places under the name Cloudy Mountain. It had randomly generated mazes filled with monsters. It had bosses. It had items you could collect. But it didn't really incorporate any actual Dungeons & Dragons stuff. Didn't have any of the monsters. Didn't have character classes or anything like that. So what happened here, really until 87, D&D wasn't themselves, TSR wasn't really moving in a meaningful way. But you had a couple of major video game series that kind of took up the mantle of this is Dungeons & Dragons as a video game, you know, just with the serial numbers filed off. And those two series were Wizardry and Ultima, but they were not licensed from TSR. TSR considered making their own video games. They passed on the idea. Ultima, for me, Ultima 4, when I think I was like 9, maybe when that came out, maybe like, I want to say that was like 85 or something like that. That was, in retrospect, kind of a life-changing game for me. I wasn't really familiar with Dungeons & Dragons except for, you know, maybe the 80s cartoon and some toys that were available at that time. But Ultima 4 was a really seminal D&D experience. You recruited a party of NPCs. They all had different character classes. It had leveling up. It had experience points. It had equipment. It had spells and monsters. And it told a story. It had a narrative, a pretty compelling, you know, by the standards of those times, some, you know, interesting story about morality and growing as a person and also, you know, fighting dragons and demons. It's a pretty influential, I think, game for me as far as gaming and storytelling through gaming. In 1987, TSR finally is like, okay, we want to really make a major series of officially licensed Dungeons & Dragons games. And at least 10 different companies applied, including Electronic Arts and Origin Systems, which were the people making Ultima. But TSR ultimately awarded that contract to Strategic Simulations Incorporated, SSI. Their primary experience was computerized wargaming. So just knowing who was in TSR at the time and what their philosophies were, I could see where that was very appealing to them. And they made this really successful series called the Gold Box series of games. I, to tell you the truth, as somebody who was like a huge Ultima fan and really liked the care and thought that went into those games, I was never blown away by the Gold Box games, but I guess I'm wrong because these are held up as like, people are hugely nostalgic. If you are a geeky child of that era who is into D&D, people really, really loved these games. It never worked for me. I always thought Ultima was better, but the games were really successful. And SSI had that license from 87 until 1994. When TSR then divided the license among multiple publishers. So the first big game they made in 88 was called Pool of Radiance, and that was part of a four-part series of games. And this also was a multi-platform game. You could get it on the NES, the original Nintendo system, as well as Apple and PC. Group of player-controlled adventurers. They saved the ruined city of Flan from invading monsters. This had class. This had alignment. This had combat options that were straight from D&D. It also allowed you to do stuff like talk your way out of fights. Combat wasn't always the solution to everything. And SSI was really the first company that got into developing games for what were kind of the seminal first and second edition Dungeons & Dragons settings. D&D, particularly second edition, is famous for like all of a sudden there's a lot of settings. So, you know, if you're talking about 88 through 96, you're primarily talking about second edition Dungeons & Dragons, and the Gold Box games reflected that. They had games set Forgotten Realms, Dragonlance, Dark Sun, Ravenloft, Al-Qadim, Spelljammer. They came out with the Eye of the Beholder series, which is like a first-person dungeon crawler. Again, really well-received. In 91, they came out with the first version of Neverwinter Nights. This will start to be a confusing title because there's three different games called Neverwinter Nights. The original one is 1991, and that was the world's first graphical online multiplayer RPG. So like before World of Warcraft, before, you know, any of that stuff, this was the first massive multiplayer online game that had graphics. And it had turn-based combat. It had player versus player. They organized their own guilds and they staged special events. When the game first launched, each individual server could support a maximum of 50 people. By 1995, the servers could support 500 people and eventually 2,000 people. It eventually closed down in 1997. I never played it. I'm not a huge fan of massive multiplayer online games, but those would also come to be very influential and in turn had some effects on the tabletop game. There's a little bit of wilderness years here after SSI loses the license. There's a series of sort of not very well remembered, different companies. TSR licenses it out to a lot of different companies. People take different shots at making games that have kind of vanished into history. Eventually, they award Interplay Productions, the license to use Forgotten Realms and Planescape trademarks for computer and video games. And within Interplay, there was a division called Black Isle Studios. He used this license arrangement to develop a series of successful games based on Forgotten Realms and Planescape. They published Baldur's Gate series, the original Baldur's Gate, which was developed by a Canadian company, BioWare. They made Icewind Dale. They made Planescape Torment. In 2003, they ran into some financial difficulties, which resulted in the closure of Black Isle Studios and the scrapping of their next planned D&D video game, which was codenamed Jefferson. There were some legal issues with Wizards of the Coast, who bought TSR during the time that Interplay had the license to make those games. But those Infinity Engine games are really fondly remembered. We may be moving a little bit into your era now, David. I'm not sure if you ever played any of those, like the original Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 or Icewind Dale 1 and 2 or Planescape Torment. This would be like 98 to like 2002.
Yeah, so it's funny because the first and second Baldur's Gate is probably the first D&D video game, even though I didn't know it was D&D at the time, that I had heard about. My cousin discovered it, and him and his buddy spent the entire weekend playing, almost nonstop. Uh-huh. and he was telling me about how great it was and all this stuff, and then the second one came out, and he played it. But I was probably like, you know, at least for the first one, I was probably like 10.
A child,
you know, but I just find it hilarious because after Baldur's Gate 3 dropped, I texted him and I was like, dude, I was like, you must buy this. I was like,
yeah. So, this is interesting. So, how is he like, as a fan of the original games, is he there's sort of different camps on this? Some people are a little bit hostile to the new game, and some people think it's a great, you know, continuation of the series, or perhaps he didn't care at all. But did he have strong feelings about the new game?
I mean, it's been like, what, 20 years since Baldur's Gate 2? Yeah,
the first one was 98, December 98, and the second one was 2000. So it's actually been 23 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. For him, when he played the first two, they were games.
Yeah.
They weren't a segue into the D&D world. It wasn't, they were just, these were games. These games were fun. I enjoyed them. And so I think that's kind of his approach now, where he hasn't tried it yet. I think he's going to get it eventually. So he's open to it. He's down for it. You know, obviously a lot changes in 23 years. You know, life happens. And
yeah. For me, when the first Baldur's Gate game came out, 98 was the year that I graduated from college. And I think I'd actually, you know, stopped playing tabletop Dungeons and Dragons pretty much when I graduated high school. So it had been about 4 years since I had actually played D&D. And it was the first video game for me that sort of, I felt like it very much captured the magic of playing D&D at a table, in the sense that it had dynamic gameplay and storytelling, and it respected player choices in ways that I think are still influencing games today. You know, it was a party with NPCs you could talk to, and NPC interactions were primitive by the standards, certainly of Baldur's Gate 3, but it felt sort of lived in. and inhabited and alive in a way that, you know, a lot of video games don't usually. This was another one that was hugely successful. A lot of people played, particularly the first Baldur's Gate and then Baldur's Gate 2. Planescape Torment, which is a wonderful, wonderful game, in some ways a superior game, you know, in terms of the writing and interesting setting and characters, that did not do nearly as well. I think because people kind of want their Tolkien-esque D&D, I think, especially more casual players. And Planescape was like a little weird, and maybe they spent a little too much money commensurate to how much that was ever going to draw. But Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, blow away success in a way that really wouldn't be emulated, you know, until, frankly, this month. Planescape Torment was 99. Icewind Dale, which is also set in Forgotten Realms, but this was a little, it used the same engine as Baldur's Gate. It was a little more combat focused. You know, it had its story, but you created your whole party. There weren't joinable NPCs. It was a little more hack and slash than Baldur's Gate, which felt like a more well-rounded CRPG. Baldur's Gate 2, Shadows of Om, was released in 2000. That was kind of the magnum opus. And the Icewind Dale 2 was the final entry in the Infinity Engine series. The cool thing about this, most of these games, Baldur's Gate, Baldur's Gate 2, Icewind Dale, and Planescape Torment, they were resurrected and given a little bit of a polishing up by a company called Beamdog, you know, within the past 5 to 7 years, and given enhanced editions. So they're available still, you know, in most marketplaces, GOG.com or Steam or whatever. But they're also available as apps that you can run on a smartphone, which is funny because they were like cutting edge, high memory demanding games when they were launched, but you can totally play them all like on your iPhone now. Pretty small screen, a lot of little tiny characters moving around, but it totally works, or like on an iPad. You know, those still have a pretty substantial following even now, you know, decades later. They were followed by the second game called Neverwinter Nights in 2002. This was the thing that BioWare did after the Infinity Engine. No more Infinity Engine gameplay, no more isometric perspective. Sort of had like polygon visuals, used a third edition Dungeons & Dragons rule set. The main campaign was dreadful, but there was a lot of great expansions. And the most important thing this is remembered for is the inclusion of an interactive tool set that allowed ambitious players to construct their own adventures. And this had a really robust community of people doing that, people using Neverwinter Nights and Neverwinter Nights 2's tool set to like recreate classic modules and their own adventures, many of which were better than like the official campaign that shipped with the game. And ever since, there's been the release of numerous player-made works that have depth and complexity rivaling what BioWare itself did with that game. The third game, called Neverwinter, was from 2013. And this is by Perfect World Entertainment, and that uses fourth edition rules. And it's very action-centric, and it is an MMORPG, and that is still active today. And it's a free-to-play title. As a sizable community, it's updated pretty regularly, usually with some tie into whatever the latest hardcover adventures. Like there's a Curse of Strahd iteration of it. There's a Tomb of Annihilation iteration of it. I'm not sure if they've really kept up with some of the more recent ones, but for a while they were pretty actively updating and releasing expansions for that thing that had to do with what was going on with fifth edition adventures, although it's very much fourth edition rules. BioWare loses the right to produce D&D games and create their own franchise, which is Dragon Age, which is hugely successful and kind of the best D&D games of the 2000s into the 2010s end up being made not with a license from Wizards of the Coast. You know, it's Dragon Age, it's Mass Effect, it's Bethesda making their Elder Scrolls, Skyrim, Beamdog resurrecting the older games and releasing enhanced edition of that. So there are a lot of great CRPGs. Pillars of Eternity is a game that, you know, massive Kickstarter success, tries to kind of capture the isometric top-down spirit of the original Baldur's Gate games. First one does really, really well on Kickstarter, and it spawns Pillars of Eternity 2, which doesn't do quite as well. Tyranny, which is a little bit of an overlooked game. You know, Larian does Divinity Original Sin, Divinity Original Sin 2. Larian approaches Wizards of the Coast and tries to get the license to make a D&D game. And they actually made, using their Divinity Original Sin engine, a CRPG adaptation of Lost Mine of Phandelver, which is the starter set adventure for 5th edition. They make the whole thing. They show it to Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast is kind of like, we like this, but you need more experience. You need more development. Come back, you know, in a few years when you've grown a little bit more. So they have success with their own Divinity franchise, and eventually they do come back to Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast gives them the license to Baldur's Gate 3, and the rest is what is happening right now. David, is there anything you wanted to add? I don't know if you had experience playing the Dragon Age games or Elder Scrolls Skyrim, or like any other CRPGs that you were into leading up to the release of Baldur's Gate 3.
There's a lot of things that I now, in retrospect, see mm-hmm. the attachment to D&D, but at the time had basically no clue.
Right.
So I had a friend who was super into Neverwinter, probably the MMO version that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of looked at it. He showed me, you know, for like 5 minutes. I was kind of like, okay. And that was just kind of it.
Yeah.
Dragon Age, I actually bought and own, and I tried it a little bit, but, you know, it's just one of those things where it was denser than what I was used to.
Right.
Mechanics wise, even, you know, story and role play and all that kind. And it's not that I didn't like RPGs, but, you know, I grew up, I had a Super Nintendo. That was my first console. I was playing Mario, which they're phenomenal games. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But these are a whole different.
It's totally realm different experience. Of game. Yeah.
And so I've kind of been around them a lot, but I never played D&D either. So, but I feel like a lot of those games I could go back and appreciate now.
They asked a lot of your time and your brain, you know, and your investment, intellectual and emotional investment sometimes to get through the games. What really can't be overstated is like the fundamental influence of the tabletop game on not just the CRPG industry, but like video game industry as a whole. I mean, just if you think of like how many games just have the concept of leveling up. I mean, that's without Dungeons and Dragons, there isn't that, you know, kind of gaining experience points and progressively becoming more powerful, you know, as the game goes on, or choosing different character classes. So much of those fundamental mechanics, which we now take for granted and may not even, you know, may have encountered those things long before we encountered the game of Dungeons and Dragons. D&D is the source of all of those things. A lot of those things are used in Japan, you know, in JRPGs like Final Fantasy. That's fundamentally also, you know, has Dungeons and Dragons as the original source for all of those games, even though structurally the JRPGs are really different kinds of games. That sort of party-based mechanic where, you know, different characters have different skills and they progress as they go up and they, you know, get more powerful, level up, get different equipment, learn different spells. That's all D&D. So what has happened recently is earlier this month, Baldur's Gate 3 was released to tremendous success. It's already one of the biggest hits of the year. It has rave reviews, and it's reaching the type of audience that any video game company would kill to achieve. We don't really have reliable sales numbers yet, but the one public metric that we can look at is concurrent players on the PC gaming platform Steam, which has been pretty eye-popping, with almost 900,000 people simultaneously playing the game last weekend, making it one of the top 10 most played Steam games ever. Interestingly, somebody picked up a statement from the Belgian embassy, Larian, the game, the company that created Baldur's Gate 3 is a Belgian company. And the Belgian embassy in China made some sort of a statement in regard to discussing Belgium's tech industry that stated that Baldur's Gate 3 has sold 5.2 million copies on Steam as of August 16, 2023. Now, that is a unique statement by the Belgian embassy in China. But it's one of those things where, like, if that isn't true, it seems like a really weirdly specific number to fake. It does seem like they were talking to someone at Larian and maybe got those figures, but unconfirmed. Bloomberg reported that Baldur's Gate 3 had sold over 2.5 million units during its early access period. So pre-release, it sold 2.5. So if the Belgian embassy is correct, that means the game could have sold around 2.7 million copies in less than 2 weeks since its global launch on August 3rd, between August 3rd and August 16th. What we know is that even from publicly available data, it's clear that Baldur's Gate 3 is selling great. it topped the Steam top sellers chart for the week of August 1st, and it was also the best-selling product on the platform for the week of August 8th. And it's even surpassing like free-to-play games, Apex Legends, PUBG in terms of gross revenue, which is crazy for a paid game to be beating free-to-play games, because the sort of industry consensus is the free-to-play games with microtransactions are the way you make your money. And Baldur's Gate 3 is kind of turning that on its head a little bit. There's a lot of things that are unique about this development situation. Larian Studios, Belgian-based developer, as I said, they're based in Ghent. They're privately owned. They have about 450 employees. They have offices in 6 countries. It's a company big enough to make games at a AAA scale, but because they're private, they're not subject to the demands of the public market. Most other video game developers are either part of publicly traded companies or they're too small to make games as ambitious as Baldur's Gate 3. Larian is a weird animal in that they're like a private company that is capable of doing projects on the scope and scale of the larger publicly traded developers. Sven, I think his last name is pronounced Vinca, although I'm not completely sure. So I apologize to the Belgians if I'm fucking that up. But he's their CEO, Sven Vinca. He's the majority shareholder along with his wife. And the bulk of their funding comes from previous hits and from sales, like the pre-sale of Baldur's Gate 3. So they kind of really rolled the dice on this. If this game did not hit, they would be done. But they made their money already on the pre-sale. Vinca is also the director of the game, which puts him in a position unique in the industry. So he can make creative decisions on this game without having to compromise due to perceived financial pressures. On the flip side, this is full of risks. So there's reasons this shouldn't have worked. Like you mentioned earlier, David, it's fucking dense. It has complicated rules. It has turn-based combat that has mostly, at least people thought, gone out of style. It has so many branching paths that no player is ever going to see everything in this game. So that means the developers are spending a lot of resources on content that some people are never going to see. It was in early access for 3 years. And that, you know, while they made money, that was kind of an essential part of their revenue with those early access sales. That's also a risk because you could damage the brand by putting an unfinished product out there, which could muddle the marketing of the full release. It's hard to imagine a publicly traded company releasing a game like this without making all sorts of compromises all around, compromises that Larian didn't have to make. So having said all that, David, do you like it?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Honestly, Elden Ring came out at the beginning of this year.
Yep.
Prior to Elden Ring, I had started to kind of become a little disenchanted with video games.
Yeah.
They were feeling very bland and not worth my time. And there was lots of like time waster mechanics in there, which we can get into that later, because I'm sure that's a whole other conversation on its own.
You mean like collect or what have you?
Yeah. Here's this random quest with no depth or anything, but you collect 50 things to get a thing.
Yeah.
That didn't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or I did play World of Warcraft, and you had your dailies and you had your weeklies and you had your renown grind. And if you wanted to switch this and you wanted to switch that, and you got to start all over again. And Diablo has their seasons where you start over and over, you know.
Yeah.
Elden Ring came out and kind of like re-sparked my love of games. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this game is like the pinnacle, right? You know, this is as good as it gets. This is going to be game of the year. Hands down, no contest. Honestly, I think Baldur's Gate 3 is going to, will it win? Maybe, maybe not. It definitely deserves at least a shot at taking that title.
Yeah, and pre-release, I don't think many people would have said that. You know, even some people might have said, oh, it maybe deserves it, but there's no way that's going to actually happen. But it's got a real shot.
I think it's...
There's not only Zelda, there's not only Elden Ring, there's Tears of the Kingdom, Zelda. Mm-hmm. And then there's Starfield, you know, which is coming out in September. Which, you know, could be great or could be a pile of shit. You know, we don't know yet. But that could also be another heavy hitter if it is a good game.
You know, it's funny with Starfield. Normally, that's the kind of game I might be really excited about. Because I really enjoyed Oblivion. I really enjoyed Skyrim. I played a lot of RPG games, you know, of that caliber, you know. But I kind of almost don't care. And I wonder how many people are in the same boat. Because yes, it's this huge, massive, expansive universe, but what we've been seeing is that they do these massive, expansive things and it's mostly empty space or boring fluff, you know?
Yes. I mean, or is it? That's the thing. It just feels like it might be.
Well, I know I'm speculating.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
but no, given I totally the agree history with you, of the industry.
I totally agree. Like, if it's Skyrim, I'll probably love it. If it's Fallout 4, I'll probably love it. If it's Fallout 76, I'll hate it.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is when you mentioned about people love their like Tolkien-esque settings. Yeah. I have to admit I'm guilty of that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about that type of setting. Once you start getting too advanced, it starts to kind of be like, you know, it just, I don't know, loses a certain amount of.
Well, I don't think magic. There's anything wrong with that or anything ashamed of it. It's also, you know, if you're not going to do the Tolkien-esque setting with the tropes that, you know, sort of culturally we can take as read, that a lot of people who are going to buy my CRPG kind of know the basic Tolkien-esque tropes, and I don't have to spend time world building and explaining all that stuff as much.
Yeah.
If I'm going to do something else, then you, the player, have to be, you know, strap in for the lore. You may or may not have the time and bandwidth to absorb all that. We all have busy, full lives. Not necessarily do we have the space in them to you know, wrap our heads around Planescape or Spelljammer or, you know, other more esoteric settings, even though there might be some really cool ideas, even though, yes, like they might be very fun if we would like invest the time in them. But the reality is a lot of people just don't have that time.
I'm very much more in that boat these days. I have a lot less time. Basically, I played Elden Ring and then I didn't play anything else until Baldur's Gate 3 came out this year. What I will say is, yes, they can be dense and it's a lot of lore, but I really feel it's also how it's delivered. Mm-hmm. I think a game like Dragon Age might just kind of expect you to either you're going to be into it or you're not. You know what I mean? And then that's just it. But I feel like Baldur's Gate in the beginning does a really good job, you know, especially because 5e's design, when you're level one, you really don't have that many things.
Right.
And they start you off with a fighter. I don't think that's really a spoiler. That's like one of the first people
you recruit. One of the first joinable NPCs you get is a fighter. Yeah.
Yeah, so they really ease you in and they give you a really awesome hook in a intro scene that isn't too long. It's just enough to go, holy cow.
I was also going to say, I don't know if you've noticed, I don't know if you played in early access, they trimmed that introductory sequence considerably. Yeah. And I think it was a really good move.
Yeah, definitely.
And you're right, it starts you know, it's a high stakes situation, it's dramatic, but mechanically it's not overwhelming.
And even lore-wise, they don't start with a giant 15-minute intro sequence explaining the lore of the world and the this. And, you know, they just kind of go, hey, you're this person and this crazy thing just happened to you.
Yeah, it's like, so you as the player and the character you're playing both start out with the mindset of what the fuck is going on here.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, and you're not really assumed, your character isn't really assumed to know a lot more than you do. Yeah, that's really skillfully handled. And I think I haven't finished. I assume you haven't finished the game yet either. I don't think a lot of people have. We're recording this on the 20th of August. I am into, I did yesterday get into the third act. It does continues to do an excellent job of gradually increasing complexity at the point at which you're ready for it. And also varying anything but a monotonous gameplay experience. Environments are different. There are story twists, you know, that will keep re-engaging you. A variety of characters that you can meet. You know, the different ways you can approach problems. The combat, when it happens, is very fun, but it doesn't happen so often that it becomes grindy or monotonous. It's the pacing is just very well done.
They definitely nailed that. And what the other thing is, you have so many options that you as a player, depending on the kind of thing you would want to do, you probably can.
Yeah.
And I feel like every option is interesting.
Yeah. It's shocking the amount of in-depth responses they have anticipated that deploy when you do something outside the box. That there was a human writer somewhere back there thinking, yep, we thought you might do that. And here's what happens when you do. And that's what makes it most feel like you're playing with a human DM. Like the amount of different things you can try to do, and the game actually tolerates you having that degree of freedom and, you know, has anticipated and provides a path to play out those choices that you make.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when I was originally talking to someone about the game, and I think it was like the day it came out, so I had maybe been able to play for a half an hour before I had this conversation. And I told them, I was like, yeah, I was like, you know, I think they're doing a really good job at adapting it to a video game format. But I'm like, you know, there's always the limitations of, you know, a video game and a DM who can actively respond to the players, where you can kind of do like anything. But the more I've played it, like you said, it is impressive what they have allowed. And for a video game, it is impressively flexible in what you can
it
do.
Is like, impressively flexible and responsive. But it also, you know, listen, it speaks to, it took 450 people working 6 years to deliver the degree of flexibility that you enjoy probably most times you play D&D, you know, tabletop with a human DM. That's just the reality. It's a difficult experience to emulate, but this is probably the best job anybody's done so far in a video game of making it feel like you have the same flexibility. You don't, by the way. It still doesn't quite have. Of course, it can't.
But it is enough.
Yeah, it is enough. It is enough to be fun, and it, you know, yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Why is the, having said that, it could be doing that, and that might not necessarily be enough for it to be enjoying the popular financial success, right? That it's enjoying right now. Why do you think that is? Like, why is it the top selling game on Steam? Why is this pushed a button with, like, frankly, like a not a D&D audience? You know, like not necessarily an audience that maybe thinks they hate RPGs or has never played a game like this before. To hit this sort of popularity and these sales numbers, they've got those people somehow. Do you have any notion about why? Like, why this game?
So I definitely think it's multifaceted. There is no one thing. I do know that my disenchantment with video games, while, you know, not everyone feels that way, there's definitely a sentiment. There's more people than just me who have been feeling a little like, man, video games these days are kind of bland. You know what I mean?
Yeah. A little scammy in some cases.
Right. Yeah. All the microtransactions. Yeah. So I think there was a certain amount of sentiment of people are just like, man, can I just get a good game, and can I just play it, and can I just enjoy it? Like, that's it. Can I just enjoy the game?
Yeah.
And Elden Ring did deliver that. Uh-huh. But if you see, Elden Ring was another one of those. Holy. I mean, yeah, they've been making Souls games for years, but wow. Like, all of a sudden, like, who plays Souls games? There's those weird people over there who love, you know, getting tortured. You know, it's like, but yeah, it hit this huge, just hit this string in the industry right now, and people really resonated with it. I think Baldur's Gate is part of that similar vein of, it's not new,
right?
But it is something almost forgotten in the mainstream, if you will, re-brought to life and done in such a great way. And so I think it's a mixture of people just wanting good games. I definitely think there's a certain group of people that when they heard that, they were like, no, there are no microtransactions. No, there is no DLC. It's feature complete, you know, which that's a term you don't hear as much these days.
Yep.
Here, just go enjoy the game.
Yeah. What Sven says is like the game is in the box. That's what, yeah. What, you know? Yeah. And people are still like, what do you mean there's no DLC? Like, there's still a certain amount of incredulity about that.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, they're just going to bring it out later.
Yeah,
so you hope they'll do it later. But what's interesting, what I find really interesting also with the Steam numbers, is that it actually kept going up for a while. It kept breaking that top number. It wasn't just like the first weekend, boom, everyone tried it the first weekend, and then it kind of, you know, started to peter off. It actually grew.
Second weekend was bigger than the first. Yeah.
Which that is not common. I don't look at the Steam charts for every single game that comes out, but that is not common. Because Cyberpunk, that was one of the games that broke my soul a little bit. I was so hyped for that game.
Yeah.
And
my wife was really, I was like, I don't know, but this is kind of fun. Keanu's in it, whatever. My wife was like super like, Cyberpunk's going to be, this is going to be the year of Cyberpunk for me. And like, she played it and she's kind of like, kind of not that good. She'd really like built it up and it was just bad. And it wasn't even bad. It was just whatever.
Right. It was definitely an expectation setting. And I think that's also part of what plays into Baldur's Gate 3. Yeah. I don't think a lot of people had, even Sven was like maybe 100,000.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
You know, and he wanted to do well. And for him, he got 100,000. He'd be, you know, celebrating.
Yeah. You know, Dungeons and Dragons is a good IP. Mm-hmm. God knows it didn't hurt. You know, I do think there are certain people, the TTRPG has been enjoying quite a renaissance over the past decade. That audience seems to be growing. I think, you know, they got the IP at the right time. But I certainly don't think you can just say, well, because it's Dungeons and Dragons. I don't think that's any kind of guarantor of this level of success. I just think it's like, it's one more thing that's like definitely in there. Just like, you know, it was a successful franchise 20 years ago. There was a certain, you know, people that are in their 40s, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s now that played it. And they're like, yeah, some of those people are going to come back for it too. Some people like Divinity Original Sin and they will come back for the thing Larian's doing next. Like all of that is in there, but they also hit people that never heard of any of that shit.
Well, that's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
Dungeons and Dragons, for certain people, Dungeons and Dragons will be a selling point.
Sure.
For some people, it'll actually be a turnoff. They'll be like, oh, I tried that at one point and it wasn't that interesting. So whatever. Yeah. This game, definitely, if you just took out everything D&D related, would still be a phenomenal game that stood on its own. Like, yeah. Hands down.
I think for me, the heart and soul of what is working here, the gameplay is great. The graphics are very, very good. It's, you know, the gameplay is fun. The gameplay improved a lot over EA. They genuinely listened. They tweaked things. It's a much better game, gameplay-wise, than it was in October 2020 when the EA first dropped. But it's the writing. Like, the writing is just really, really good. Fundamentally, two writers and, like, a world-building consultant. That kind of reminds me of the F. Murray Abraham character on Mythic Quest every time they have him speak. But, you know, he is an old school. He wrote White Plume Mountain, like the original, you know, first beloved first edition D&D module. They got, you know, they kind of dug up this professor emeritus of D&D to like be the lore consultant. And then they got these two great writers to, you know, lead up the team. Not too many people. And I also think that's like a major improvement over Divinity Original Sin, because the writing in Baldur's Gate 3 is way, way better. And that was like the biggest criticism I think that people had of Divinity Original Sin, is like, the game is really fun to play. The plot and dialogue, you know, could use some work. And the character-to-character, moment-to-moment writing, the narration, dialogue when you're talking to NPCs, the overarching plot and storytelling is of a very high standard. Shockingly high. I would go so far as to say, frankly, a better written game than, generally speaking, the 5e adventures. Like, it's better writing than you'll find in the 5e hardcover adventures.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm DMing for the first time now, and so I'm kind of getting a peek on that side of the world, and I'm writing a published adventure, and there's a lot of fantastic things about it, but I feel this overwhelming urge when I'm working with it to be like, okay, I'm going to extract the principles. I'm going to rewrite a bunch of stuff.
Sure.
And I'm not even a writer.
Like, yeah. Yeah, but I think that's the correct approach to, you know, any pre-written adventure.
Yeah.
Which one are you running? Remind me.
Call of the Netherdeep, Critical Roles.
Yeah. Which I've read most of, but not run that.
I love the ideas of it. I love certain things. I just find that with the group and how players act and how player characters are, sometimes like the pre-written dialogue piece that you're supposed to read out just doesn't seem to
the text boxes fit. Yeah, it can be come off very stilted, and also like, well, that's clearly not true because you know, only my familiar went in that room. What do you mean I saw that? Yeah.
The best part is when I read something and I realize after I've read it that I've either contradicted something else I've said, or like I said, I stated something, or I read the part that wasn't supposed to be read out loud to the players.
Yep.
Yep. I was like, oh, oops. It's like, yeah.
So sort of dovetailing off of that, how do you think the success of Baldur's Gate 3 will affect the tabletop game, if at all?
I don't know if we're going to see, you know, 50 million new D&D players off of it. Mm-hmm. There still is. I have some friends who it's got to have good graphics. Like, they just it just does. Like, they won't play a TTRPG. because there's no graphics, you know. So there's definitely going to be a group of people like that. What I do think it is good for is people who don't know that they might enjoy D&D. I was one of these people not that long ago. I only started playing maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago at this point, because it gives you an introduction to the mechanics. It gives you an introduction to the world, the races, the classes, the setting.
Yeah.
You know, it's set in it's the Forgotten Realms in Faerun, you know, so like this is all like the baseline. This is all the stuff you would have to sit down and explain to a new player and watch their eyes glaze over. They're like, yeah, you know what? I'm good. Yeah, but if they know it all.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm shocked at like, it's really Forgotten Realms-y. Yeah. Like, I don't want to spoil too much because I'm not sure how, and I'm, certainly there'll be people listening to this that may not have started yet or may not be very far at all. But like, Forgotten Realms is like the kitchen sink Dungeons & Dragons setting. I frankly, even though I used it for years, I've never loved it. But it serves its purpose in that it is generic, and you can like any D&D thing there is, you can put in Forgotten Realms and there's a place for it. And it's recognizably Tolkien-esque in the way that we discussed earlier. In fifth edition, I have really learned to love Forgotten Realms in a way that I never have previously, because I think it's been handled more interestingly than it was during the first and second editions, which is what I played when I was a kid. Baldur's Gate 3 is a great take on Forgotten Realms. I love what they've done with the lore and the factions, and they've made stuff that I found clunky or hokey in the past. They kind of made it cool. It's neat to see. Yeah, people will be equipped with all of that setting stuff and the different classes and subclasses and spells. Like, people will come equipped with that familiarity with those things. I also expect WotC to react to the success of this game. But the funny thing is with WotC's development cycle is the time it takes them to create product is like, right now, they're still working on, oh, we need a big Vecna adventure because of the last season of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
You know, which was 3 years ago, I think. And so we're getting that next year because that's like as current as they can be. You know, and after that, we're getting Fey stuff, like Red Wizard stuff, because of the D&D movie from this year. You know, and that'll be after Vecna. So, like, I'm sure they're right now going, like, we need a Baldur's Gate thing. We need Mind Flayers. Do it right away. And that right away means, like, coming soon in 2027, this adventure that ties into Baldur's Gate 3. You know, they tried to get ahead of it a little bit, because Baldur's Gate 3 is actually sort of a sequel to Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus, which, you know, which is a tabletop adventure that came out, Jesus, like 2018 or 2019. I think 2019 is when Descent into Avernus came out. They should have something out right now for the people that are like, oh, I really love this game. What is the Baldur's Gate 3 D&D thing that I can buy that also came out this month? And there's like no synchronized marketing like that.
Path of the Giant.
yeah. Here's a book about giants. There aren't any in the game, but here's giants. But like, pivot, like, do something. Why is there not like some digital product on D&D Beyond right now that's like Baldur's Gate 3? Here's a Nautiloid that you can, you know, one shot that you can run. Here's like this thing set in Baldur's Gate. Here's something that we wrote this month. Like, I don't know. They need to be ready to pounce more on these sorts of hits that they should anticipate could happen. Like, it hasn't been a secret that this game's coming out this month. I don't know. I could talk about what I would do if I was in charge of WotC. But
anyway. Well, I'll say this. I think it's a mixture of things. A, I don't think anyone expected it to have the splash that it did.
No, not like this. You but know, like it was going to be, you know, a pretty successful game. Like, we knew from early access, like, this wasn't a flop.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, I work at a large company. And when I see the decisions that get made holistically, like when you just look at the company,
yeah,
there's so much that happens that I'm just like, this is dumb. Like, this is not why are we doing this? But, you know, from my experience internally and what I see is this department and that department and that department over there and this department over here don't talk to each other. And you know, you have a lot of pressures and priorities coming from top down.
Sure.
That aren't as in tune with something that's necessarily going on over there.
Absolutely. And I would argue that's the big difference between, say, Larian and Watsy.
Right. Yeah. And that's an excellent example of it is, you know, this is a owner who was also active in the development, who also was, I'm pretty sure I saw a clip of him in like full armor.
Yeah. Yep. He always wears his full suit of armor on like every one of the like coming soon video specials that they do where they talk about new features and stuff.
I hope more companies realize that, like, you know, I hope they take a product and let it function more in and of itself. In other words, you know, give a game an IP, mm-hmm. you know, bring the movie making and the video game making and the product making of a specific IP together, right? Yeah. Rather than, well, here's the video game making section of the company and that's the marketing section of the company over there. And, you know, let them actually go, hey, you know what? I think it'd be a good idea if we actually like work together on this.
Yeah. I think, you know, just talking about on a design and mechanical level, I do notice as I mess around with the character builder in Baldur's Gate 3, they have spotted some pain points in, you know, 5e character design and builds and address them. I think people who've played 5e and then play this will notice that Larian fixed like the Beastmaster Ranger and fixed the Berserker Barbarian. And just like on a basic level in that sense, I would not be surprised if some of the game design fixes actually do end up getting carried through to the tabletop stuff that like Larian played with, you know, what was designed for 5e and was like, oh yeah, people are going to hate this or people do hate this. And I kind of see why. And, you know, for this class to function on equal footing with, we can't ship it like that. I think there's some stuff in there that may end up sort of back end the game that Baldur's Gate 3 was based on may end up changing some mechanics and things like that due to stuff that was done in Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah.
I also just think generally in terms of writing, I'll take Call of the Netherdeep, for example, since you're playing. It's a very, not a major spoiler. This is like the opening kind of prologue adventure. There's like a carnival sort of contest going on, correct, at the beginning of Call of the Netherdeep, where the Yeah. adventurers are called upon to compete against a rival group of adventurers that involves a kind of underwater sequence where they have to swim into this grotto. And at one point, the sort of climax of that is there's an underwater chamber with there's a shark in it.
Yep.
And a giant shark and a spear is stuck in the shark. And you would need that spear to win the contest.
Actually, it's an amulet.
Okay.
Around it's an amulet. The shark.
But yeah. There's like, isn't there something stuck in
there's
the shark?
There's a spear. Yeah.
Okay. There's an amulet. I believe the adventure is written like, and when the shark dies, it crashes into a wall, breaking this wall open. But like you've sent the adventurers down there not to kill a shark.
Yep.
You sent them to get an amulet. So like they might have speak to animals. They might put the shark to sleep. Like there are so many other ways to solve that. Like they just get the amulet, they swim out, shark doesn't die and break the wall down. And mm-hmm. incidentally, breaking the wall down is like plot essential, right? Like they have to get into that next chamber because there's some magical MacGuffin in there that kind of is the impetus for the whole rest of the campaign.
Yeah.
And like, that's just like, did you playtest that? And like that, like, you know, and like also, this is also dumb, but like there's a giant shark. It can't get in or out of that room because it's too big to fit mm-hmm. through any of the entrances or exits on the map that you drew and put a giant shark in. And like, that's the kind of thing where like, if you did that in Baldur's Gate 3, somebody would notice and be like, oh, well, you can't possibly publish it like that. And like, that's the sort of thing I'd love to see Watsy take a look at. Like, did we play test this? Like, does that actually, cause like in a video game, somebody will notice when the shark is too fat to fit through the exit and and you tell people to take the amulet and they take the amulet and swim away and the shark never breaks the wall, you know, and like, there's just shit like that that's in those books a lot. And it's like, if I was making like this, like AAA level video game, I bet it wouldn't be like that. I bet somebody would have like anticipated this. So I'd like to see the writers maybe take a page out of the writers, but the design book from Baldur's Gate 3. Of course you cannot and should not try to anticipate every fucking thing players might do. You just can't. And the part of the beauty of D&D is that you can't, but there are some basic stuff that like, you need to be better than that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. How did that play out for you? Did they kill the shark?
Almost everything you listed, they tried to do.
Yeah.
you probably remember when I posted the question about what Mage Hand can and cannot do.
Okay. Yep.
But I was feeling generous that night, and that was my problem. You know, I basically let the wizard do an arcana check to see if he could, like, slip the amulet off.
Yeah, and, like, if that's reasonable, I think. Right, I actually think that's a pretty reasonable use. Oh, I got the amulet. I'm out of here. I used my mage hand.
Now, technically, the giant shark has, like, and I'm sorry to my players if they listen to this, and I'm spoiling a little bit of the, Coville's favorite word? Vermissitude?
Verisimilitude, yeah.
There you go, verisimilitude. Yeah. The shark has like 60 feet of blind sight, so really it should know they're there basically the second they come down the tunnel and attack, which is what the book says, but that just feels a little... I like to give my players a chance to like, ooh, okay, we see that thing, what do we do? Mm-hmm. You know, well, turns out they tried to break the game. That's what they did. And so, you know, I literally had to throw certain obstacles in their way to discourage them from just like snagging the amulet and leaving.
Yeah.
And I had to have the rival party come in and fight, because to be honest, I'm running it with four people. So they're actually at a little bit of a disadvantage. So this is a giant shark and they're all level three. They're looking at this thing. This thing's deadly to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're like, yeah, we're going to leave. You know?
Yeah, like, totally.
And so I basically had to almost like force interactions to happen to then cause the wall to break.
Yeah. And my feeling is you as a DM shouldn't be put in that spot.
Yeah.
Like, of course, if your players do something wildly off the res, then like, okay, you know, you're on your own. You have to deal with it. Far from unreasonable move in a situation like that. And that sort of thing comes up again and again where it's just like, I feel like there's too much of a philosophy of like, DM will fix it. You know, and like writing adventures is hard. It really is. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to write a good adventure. But like Larian did it, so it can be done. And I know like a computer game is not a hardcover book, but like there's some things that you look at this encounter and be like, actually, is this going to work? Like, what am I not thinking of? What assumptions have I made that are, you know, which really makes me think that Baldur's Gate 3 had 3 years of people trying to break it, right? Yeah. Effectively, like 3 years of people playtesting it. I don't think the playtesting cycle for any of these written books is anything like that. And I think that is a problem. So I do think that a lesson that WotC could take from Larian in this case is like, did you really playtest this shit before you sold it?
You know what's funny? I'm pretty sure if they did like early access to their adventures and gave it to people, not everyone.
Yeah. No, but enough people would.
And they would break a ton of stuff and be like, yeah, this is what happened. They'll be like, oh,
yeah. But so in closing, because we're a little over an hour and I don't want to keep you too long. There's one more big question that I wanted to ask, because we had these kind of two, you know, non-core product D&D things that happened this year, by which I mean like exterior to the tabletop game itself, right? We had Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, the movie, which was released, I want to say, in March of 2023. And then this month, we had Baldur's Gate 3 released. And one thing we'll say about Honor Among Thieves is it did somehow, we now know, it caused a measurable spike in sales of the TTRPG product. So people did see that movie and want to go play D&D, like a substantial number of people. So in that sense, maybe it was a success, but it was not a box office success, right? There may be intangibles and ancillaries that it's difficult for us to quantify branding wise. This is actually worth the money because it had these other benefits. But in terms of making money in and of itself, it's going to be real close whether Honor Among Thieves ends up being a profitable venture as a movie. Whereas Baldur's Gate 3 is a blockbuster success already.
Yeah.
Why did one successfully reach a breakthrough audience of casual non-D&D fans? Because I think Honor Among Thieves, like if you played D&D, you probably liked it and the critics liked it. But it really didn't have a lot of just sort of like, I think casual people saw the trailer and were like, oh, this is another piece of shit CGI movie I don't need to go see. Why did Baldur's Gate 3 reach those people? and Honor Among Thieves kind of didn't, at least not to the level that it sort of needed to.
So I would say part of it is Baldur's Gate 3 is just an amazing game, like D&D aside.
Right, right. Whereas Honor Among Thieves is like a good, fun movie, but it's not like an amazing movie.
Right. Like, yeah. I did really enjoy it. Yeah. And yes, as someone who plays D&D and you see all the references to stuff and you're like, oh, that's a thing. Oh, that, like, they don't even mention it, but like you see it, like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know Simon's character sheet says he has X amount of charisma, but I'm pretty sure he's a sorcerer who has a charisma of like 8. You know what I mean? And, you know, he put all his stats into, I don't know, int for some reason. You know, he didn't know how his class worked.
Yeah.
I think the movie was safe, mm-hmm. which is good in the sense of it's not just for the fans.
Yep.
My wife doesn't care that much to play D&D, mm-hmm. but she enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
It's not a movie like, ooh, this is the best movie I've ever seen. But like, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's hard to imagine anybody coming out of that angry.
Right. Yeah. But it also released, I'm pretty sure, right around the time the Mario movie came out.
Yeah, it got killed by Mario.
Yeah, so that was a huge one. I mean, Baldur's Gate 3 pushed up their release by a month to
get away from Starfield. Yeah, which turned out to be a smart move.
Yeah, and it was a good thing they went earlier.
Yeah.
Because, well, that's actually, I remember when Horizon Forbidden West came out and Elden Ring dropped 2 weeks later. You had 2 weeks of the internet just like, oh, Forbidden West. Elden Ring came out. Forbidden West just dropped off the map, like, utterly after 2 weeks. And I heard it was a good game. I own it. It's sitting there, still shrink wrapped. I'll get there eventually. But I definitely think it was.
Yeah, it was clobbered by Mario. Yeah. And, you know, it was a savvy move for Baldur's Gate 3 to get out from under Starfield. I think there's no doubt. I also don't think you can totally say, oh, Mario killed it.
No, not entirely. But,
you know, but that was a big factor. No doubt. No doubt a big factor. And the fact that it has had some traction in streaming does suggest that, like, once people did, you know, have time to get around to it, it does have some legs with people. But I think I want to circle back to the first thing you said, which is that it's really safe.
Yeah.
It's made an effort to appeal to everybody. I think it's PG-13. It's not like completely sanitized, but you know, it's a broad, welcoming romp. It is a romp.
Yeah.
And I would say the two big D&D success stories of the past decade are not safe. It's Critical Role and it's Baldur's Gate 3. And both are R-rated, you know, not like pornographically R-rated, but like they're both R-rated. They're not shooting for let's get everyone. They are leaning into an adult audience and adults, but I mean, teens and up, like, you know, sort of smarter teens and up. There's cursing, there's sex, there's like genuinely like socially progressive and, mm-hmm. you know, really unapologetic about that. But it's like they say fuck and there's nudity and it's kind of violent and like. They both hit it really big by just being like, yep, we're doing this. You know, there's a druid turns into a bear and has sex. You know, and like all that stuff. Like there's, yeah, like people are gay, deal with it.
So as far as like the people are gay and all that, deal with it.
Yeah.
The one thing I will say, though, that both of them do is it just is. That's not the focus of it. Yes, exactly. Just is.
They don't get up there and.
Yeah.
They don't pat themselves on the back about it. This is how life actually is. People actually curse. People, you know, have sex with different people. And, you know, that's just sort of a reflection of, you know, our lives or, well, you know, how we'd like our lives to be. It's like, you know, everyone's hotter than people are in real life. But like, other than that, it's not strident, you know, and it's not self-congratulatory in that way. It's just like, yep, yeah, it's there. But it also doesn't back down. You know, it doesn't apologize. It's not like, oh, we're sorry to upset you.
Right, yeah, no. Which is fine. Like, that's great. Like so this ties into what the other thing I was going to say was that the thing that, so I've only seen really season 2 of Critical Role.
Yeah.
Because people were like, oh, that's where it was good. And I'm still catching up on it because,
sure,
you know, it's a lot.
It's going to break your heart.
I think I'm getting close to that part. So,
yeah. Suffice it to say, it sometimes that show takes a very long time to get nowhere in particular. And that's my main grievance with it. But yeah, so go ahead.
They definitely do. There's definitely lulls, but then they do tend to circle back around and then it gets super interesting again. What I was going to say was the one thing that I really noticed, and I think is the thing that I like, because I've watched other D&D actual plays and I have some other ones I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's one from Viva La Dirt League. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're Australian comedy group, but they started playing D&D and it's hilarious because the DM knows what he's doing.
Sure.
None of the players know what they're doing.
Yeah.
This is all the first time. Well, except for maybe one guy. This is the first time any of them played D&D.
Yeah.
And one of them's a rogue. How does sneak attack work again? So it's actually amusing on that front, but they're funny people in general. But what I feel is some of the magic of both Critical Role, at least for season two, because I haven't seen 1, 3, and for Baldur's Gate, is that I do feel that when I play Baldur's Gate, this was made by people who love this game and love to play games and are looking for a good game.
And that's
they're not looking
they're looking for a game that they would want to play.
Right. And with, you know, Matt Mercer and that group, they're a group of friends who are playing with a DM who also happens to be phenomenal, who is running the kind of game he wants to run. So they are having fun.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. They're both. I think you can say that confidently, say that about both Critical Role and Baldur's Gate 3, is they're made by people having fun who love the game.
And I think that comes through, even if people don't necessarily realize that's what they like about it so much. Especially, I mean, think about it. How many people started watching it during COVID?
Yeah.
And how like disconnected you were from everyone else to then like have this group of people, like you get to see like a group of friends and it's like, man, I missed that. Yeah. It's like, I wish I could see my friends again.
Very much so. I think that's really well observed, David. And I also think that's a great note to end the show on. So I will thank you so much. This is Tal Aviaser from Cast Party, joined by David. There'll be a new episode of Descent into Avernus, possibly out already by the time you hear this. If not, it'll be out really soon. And I will be back in September with another episode of Power Word Talk. But David, thank you very much for joining me to do the show. I really appreciate it.